I think we're ready for questions from the panel first. Jeff.
I thought for a minute I heard that you could not vote unless you had a driver's license or state ID. Okay, I thought that I had heard that, and I think Paul may have said that and then changed it to a different. Okay. That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else from the panel? Fran.
Let's see. This morning we had an interesting presentation regarding death certificates and a broadband search that was going to be implemented nationally so that you could actually verify whether or not someone was dead nationwide. And I'm sure you all heard that presentation, which sounds great. And of course, what I'm thinking is if we can do that for death records, why can't we do that for voter registration records? And it sounds like you're moving through an MOU, a voluntary states association by region, to kind of do something at a very perfunctory sort of level of cross-checking. But just because somebody's in a particular region doesn't necessarily mean that you've got the whole universe. You might be concerned about people who go to Arizona. People in Alaska might be concerned about people who go to Hawaii or Florida. You know, I mean, it's not a regional thing. We're a nation, and with a huge amount of travel and change of residence, it seems like, to me anyway, we ought to have a national system. So this idea of a statewide or a nationwide who's died and what are the records and can we cross-check leads pretty nicely, I think, once every state is up and running with a statewide voter system, to be able to do something comparable as opposed to voluntary or regional. I'd just like some response to that as to both whether or not you see any problems from your state's perspective in doing that, and secondly, if you could sort of in a, if you were in our shoes, what steps could we recommend that would get us there?
Take it first. In terms of what I heard this morning, and the one of the concerns that it raised for me was, it sounded like this nationwide search was one record at a time. And of course, what we would need to be able to do would be to pass, in our case, 3.5 million records, pass through this process to catch anyone on a national basis. What we have done to try to deal with some of that issue is take the Social Security Administration death list or file and compare it against our database. And that does help us catch some of those the people who inconveniently die outside of our state. I think that needs to be carefully looked at as far as how that can be, how that national process can work, because the process of polling all 50 states, 50 different lists is what I heard from different states, and polling them with 3.5 million voters in our case, and I don't know how about Kansas, doesn't seem like, I'm having a hard time imagining a system with that kind of capacity to do that.
Can you hear me? There we go. As far as Kansas, Brad Bryant, our election director, was here before the committee, oh, I think in August or September when you had that, and he presented, I would imagine, our agency's policy or preferences for this. I'm on the technical side, so I don't know that I can speak for the office on a national type database or, you know, that. Technically, you know, as Paul said, I think you're going to run into a lot of issues there, and I think that's the purpose of your committee, is to study that and come up with a recommendation. But regardless, our state has taken the position, again, through Brad and policy I'm implementing, that these regional cross checks do have value, especially between us and the Kansas City area, and we are getting some value out of that. Maybe not all the value, because yes, we have people that move to the East Coast of Florida, to, you know, different places, Arizona, which we're checking as well. But we're learning through this, and we're wanting to see the possibilities as well. So we're taking small steps.
I wonder what you'd get out of it in Utah. If you had a national database, you'd say, you'd go and check and you'd say, okay, John Doe has a registration in Oklahoma, and therefore what? But what do you do at that point? presumably he's moved to Utah from Oklahoma, and so we go ahead and register him anyway. There are some technical issues with that. When making a query, you have to do one of two things. Either you have to have a database with everybody in the country in it, or you have to individually query each of the 50 databases to find a person. So it isn't completely simple. There are a number of things that you could do. My guess is that that's fairly expensive on the list and has limited value, but that would be policy, and I'm just technical. I don't worry about such things. But there are some very easy things that we could do. You know, we do produce a list of everybody who moves into our state, and they have voluntarily said that they came from some other state. And that other state still has them registered. And we have to produce a paper list for each state and send it to them. They have to go in and find those people on their rolls. And there's a lot of work in that. It would cost practically nothing to have a web service where I put those on there and each state goes and gets the ones that are appropriate to them. It'd be very, very easy, very low-hanging fruit if you wanted to do something like that. And it would cost a server and, you know, a few days of programming time.
Thank you. Governor Walker.
Right. You mentioned that you were using electronic poll books for early voting. Is there plans to use it for regular voting?
Yes. In fact, we did use it a little bit last November. A few of the counties used it. We don't mandate that they use that, so there's varying degrees in each county. Electronic poll books have an interesting problem. They can't really be an internet-based solution because we can't stop an election just because somebody's router goes down. So they are, in fact, complete databases, and what they communicate is the fact that an individual has voted back up to the main database, and that is distributed back out to all of the individual electronic poll books so that they don't vote in more than one place. But if the internet's down, that transmission just doesn't happen, and then we catch them later and they go to jail. So
you perceive that other counties will adopt the electronic poll book?
Yeah, many of them use it for early voting. I mean, the counties of any size use that for early voting. And for election day, we limit it, actually. Election day, we never transmit the voter record, the vote history record, the fact that they voted, back to the individual workstation because the traffic is just too high. We couldn't guarantee that any handle that. But Box Elder County used it last election. I know that Davis County will use them exclusively for the Western presidential primary, and other counties are considering it just one at a time. I don't know which ones are doing with.
Wendy, did you have a question?
I don't remember, so it might have been Mike. One of the issues that we have when we're trying to check duplicates, I think in particular, somebody mentioned this, that you can't always base it on the registration date. You have to go back and look at where is this person actually voting, you know, or doing their change of address and things like that. So you'd also have to move all their transactions. I know we have to check every transaction between the counties to see which one that's there. Are you looking at doing that in those cross-state ones? I don't think we got that originally.
No, this is strictly right now it is they registered the same, and again, it's name and date of birth, so there has to be a lot of investigating by the counties, each county in each respective state, to determine if that is indeed the same person. But that was the limit of it. Now, there was, in Kansas anyway, we are looking at expanding that into a voting history check in the last national election to see if that same person actually voted in each of those places. The North Central MOU did not include that, I do not believe. Well, it didn't initially, and I don't believe it is for the next round, but the one that is happening for the South Central will include a voting history check of the last general election.
All right, I have some questions for you. I'm wondering if each of you could describe, let's pretend for today that I'm registering to vote in each of your states, and I've gone to a county in your state and I've submitted my card. Please describe the process in your system of that verification of my driver's license number or the last four digits of my social security number in terms of when it takes place and when the county gets word back as to whether or not there's a match or no match.
First. Okay, when you register, once you save the record, you can push the button for there's a button for verification. It verifies it immediately as to whether they are, you know, within a second or two. It tells them, and it tells them if it was verified through the DMV, then it provides a fair amount of information. If it came through an SSA, it's just matched alive, and that's about all, or did not match.
Mike?
Kansas, that's very similar. It's immediate with the Department of Motor Vehicles if they provide the driver's license. If they provide the last four, DMV is responsible for batching those up, and I believe that particular one occurs at night, and then the counties are notified via the interface that I showed. And the statuses are SSA pending if it couldn't get the connection for whatever reason. There's a pending state and it retries several times. That's configurable. And that the other statuses, I believe, are SSA verified. And then there is an SSA deceased. And there might be a couple others that I'm not remembering, but those are the main ones.
So they would hear back the next business day?
On those particular ones. I believe the majority of them do happen live through the DMV interface and the driver's license number. And then the ones that come back from SSA verified, I believe that the ID required flag at that point is removed.
Paul?
Our process sounds very similar to what Mike is talking about. The transaction, most of our registrations are probably through the mail and on a form that gets mailed to our office and then distributed to the counties. They would do the data entry in real time. That transaction comes up to the system. Meanwhile, at the local level, they've gone on to the next record. We'll do the verification process again, depending upon what kind of verification is needed and the timeliness of the response. We will send a notification to their EMS system as to whether or not that record
Okay, so is that like a 24-hour process as well, or
For the Social Security number, I don't think that that is routinely a 24-hour process, but it can be a 24-hour process on occasion.
And DMV?
DMV is real time, but even so, we're not holding up data entry at all. We have some large counties that they would be screaming at us if there was a set 1 or 2 second delay between their ability to move on to the next record. So yeah, they've already moved on to the next record, but we within 10 seconds or so at the most, we're sending back a notification as to whether it passed or not.
Just out of curiosity, because I know the laws can vary on this from state to state, at what point is a person in your process considered legally registered to vote?
I'm speaking for our office, not from policy, but from what I know. So Brad Bryant would be the policy expert there. But I believe once they're in the system, they are considered a registered voter, and these interfaces are for verifying ID on the ones that were mailed in or not presented locally and shown ID, so that the ID required flag in our system is when if they show up and show ID, you uncheck that box, and those don't go to DMV or SSA. So this is for the mail. But up until that point, they're considered registered, and if the ID required flag is checked, they have to show ID. Either the county has to follow up with that and say, hey, the next time you vote, you'll have to show ID unless you provide that now, or they have to show that at the polling place.
Yeah, right.
But they're considered registered.
Yeah, they're registered when they're when put in, and they just have to show ID at the polls.
So at the point that the election, the poll worker has entered them into the system, they are considered registered, and not until then. So if the poll, if the county elections office takes 2 weeks to enter the record, they're not registered for 2 weeks?
No. No, the date of registration is the date, I think it's the date that they actually received it. But is that?
County received it.
When we're talking about cutoff dates, if they don't, I mean, they don't have to, we don't have to have processed it in order for them to still be eligible. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. Thank you. Paul?
Shane, I think. Actually, in Washington State, the date that the applicant signed the oath is the date they are registered, and any delay between that date and the county or the state processing the application does not affect that date. So if there's a problem, their registration is always backdated. So if it's really close to an election and their application isn't processed, they'll probably vote a provisional ballot, but their registration will be backdated to the day they sign the oath.
Thank you. Paula, and then Governor Walker.
You mentioned that you, I believe it was you who mentioned that you have a really good way of dealing with the digitized signatures, and that you would prefer not to have that be devalued or taken over by some other way. And I was wondering if you, if it's brief, if you could tell us how, what that is that you are doing that, that you think is works so well.
I don't know that it basically, it's been a requirement a long, for a long time in the state that we capture the signatures, in large part because of the popularity of the absentee voting, and we check all of the signatures. I think the same systems that we have in our state are systems that are used nationwide, but it's just a part of a very normal, regular procedure that when you scan the voter registration form, you also you clip the signature, and that signature is attached to the record. And then when an absentee form comes back, and it, you know, California is very familiar with this, Oregon's familiar with this, Washington as well. When it comes back, there's some depending upon the size of the county, really efficient techniques. Many times the registration number is printed on the form, so that a batch can be scanned and the signatures are brought up just one click after another click, and you have somebody comparing the signature on the return envelope to the signature that's on the it's still a person. We're not Washington is in the process of testing some of the automatic signature verification equipment, but we haven't approved any yet. The major issue is, and I've been, and now I have to backtrack a little bit. You're going to make me embarrassed here, bragging about these digitized signatures. The main issue seems to be with the quality of the reference signature. And we've been, these signatures that we have been, that we've been gathering, these digitized signatures, have been over a period of 20 years. And 20 years ago, there wasn't any idea of that we were going to be using these signatures for to try to do an automatic signature verification. So we're going to need to improve the quality of our signatures before we're going to be at a place where we can use this technology efficiently. The other issue, of course, is that on the form that they return the signature on, you need to keep a clear space for that signature, and there's a tendency to have on the same line as the signature a place for them to put the date that they're returning it, and then right below the signature is their telephone number, and when those things merge together, it's impossible, it's very difficult for the signature verification processes to pull those out and keep them separate, from, particularly when it's handwritten.
Governor Walker, and then Charlotte.
Each one of you tell me one thing that you would do different.
Let Ray start.
I know what he would have done differently.
Song of 50 ways to leave your lover, and there must be 50 things, but because our system is always changing. We're rewriting things all the time because we find that we could have found a better way to do it. I was trying to think of something big that was meaningful. Right now, the way we attach election plans to precincts is, I wish I'd done a little differently, but that's so technical, it's hard to have meaning for you right now. Most of the things that really have been a problem, we went in and changed, so I don't know what we would do.
I have the same sort of answer, and this is also new as well, but we're constantly working on the system, constantly adding enhancements. I don't know that we change vendors even, you know, that kind of a thing. I mean, we've got the system, and that is a hard question. I mean, the time frame that we had to do it was very tight, so maybe a little more time would have yielded a few different things. I can't think of anything right off the top that we would change or do differently because we're constantly evolving the system.
I'm going to be a weasel. Both of you. we tried to be honest about the issues that we've had with the system and where the challenges were. And those challenges were in many ways directly related to particular architectural decisions that we made. We certainly get frustrated with the idea of dealing with core vendors sometimes. The keeping the local and the state databases in sync is a challenge, but we are actually proud of the design that we have. We think there's a lot of advantages to it. There's a redundancy built into the design. There is the ability, if the state system is down or communication is down, the local systems can continue to enter in voter registrations and continue to do their processes. So we think we're not overwhelming the central state system with having to have a huge bandwidth or a big powerful enough system. So we're proud of the design, but there's certainly frustrations that, boy. But I think you would find that we talked about the frustrations in all the different ways that we implemented it, that there'd be frustrations and difficulties so that they'd be different. So I don't know if there's anything I would change.
All right, Elaine, I've thought of one. One of the things is that we did spend so little money on the system to begin with, and we did not formalize a way to maintain it. That is, there not only was there nothing appropriated nor given to us out of the HAVA funds, but there was no money identified for ongoing operations. And what this has done to us is consume all of the resources in the governor's office for IT. And
I know.
And so it's made us so that in some ways we're far less doing the rest of our job that's not elections, and we should have set up some more formalized way to assure continual funding for the operation, because as I say, we are changing it every day. There are changes, requests from the counties, the legislature changes their minds about things all the time, and people just want things different, and it consumes a lot of resources for us.
Probably should mention, in order to get county support for the HAVA program, they all had punch cards. The majority of our HAVA money really went to the counties to buy all new voting machines. That was part, having talked independently to every county commissioner, not only once, twice, three times, four times, that was the final agreement. I think we had a total of $500,000 for the whole database. So I give Ray all compliments because I don't think anyone has done it nearly as efficiently, and yet we have a great system. So I want to thank you for that, Ray.
Charlotte?
Do you accept faxed applications?
Who are you asking?
All of you.
Well, They accept the faxed application. I was trying to remember. I think they do take the faxed applications.
I believe the same thing in Kansas.
That's done at the county level instead of the state level, mm-hmm. and so it makes it so I'm a little less familiar with it than I otherwise would be. I mean, it's just not an area that I actually deal with.
Yeah, that's the same thing. I believe we do, but it's a local.
Washington State, do you accept faxed applications?
I believe we do. I'm kind of, it's again that's at a state. I mean, that's at the county level, and we also accept faxed ballots in some cases, but I believe that has to be followed up with the actual ballot, and so that might be a similar situation.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions that are Kansas-specific, Mike. You made a reference that the counties can't see each other's data. I was curious what the policy reason was for that.
And maybe some clarification there. As far as see, if there's potential duplicates and that sort of thing that are alerted, they can obviously see those and make determinations, accept transfers from other counties. But as far as being able to... And maybe change would be a better word. They can't change or do anything with any other county's data.
Okay. Yeah. And also, I saw in your memorandum of understanding for your north central region, North Dakota included, and they don't have voter registration. So what database are you using for North Dakota?
Don't know.
Okay.
We didn't get any matches from them.
Wendy.
Oh, now I forgot what I was going to ask. Go on to someone else. I'll come back to it in a second.
What else on the panel?
Well, then.
Rebecca.
So in the Kansas case, you were going to become part of two separate consortia. Would you perform the role of looking for matches across those as well, or that's completely separate? So even if you identified a problem issue, like you were matching someone in both, that would not be shared information for you?
At this time, they are separate. We've talked about the possibility of doing, I think what you're saying, but at this time, it's going to be a separate.
Thank you.
Wendy remembers.
Okay. What I wanted to ask is, in your various data matching processes, whether it's with the felony list or the death list or the duplicate list, how did you establish your criteria for what was a match? What studies did you use? What testing did you do to determine what would constitute a match? And then do you have standardized procedures for each local jurisdiction to follow when you provide them that information?
I was not the one that did that, so that's a little too technical for me on that particular question, what the match criteria was. We do it kind of an interesting way, and I'm very interested in this, in that before each election, we gather the information and post that to, we undo all the ones that are on there and redo all the ones that are there now, because it was simpler than trying to figure out how people moved, and it only mattered during the election. People are released from prison all the time, and undoing them was a much bigger problem. On the other hand, another issue is how do we deal with felons, with convicted felons in other states, or convicted felons on the federal level, which we really don't get information about at all. So that is a bigger issue in my mind about making sure that we have those on there so that they cannot be used, although presumably if they're incarcerated, it's hard for them to vote. But still, that's the reason why we do it on the list, is because it's not impossible for somebody to use their registration to vote.
In Kansas, I echo what Ray said. I was not directly involved in the decisions, some discussions, but not decisions on the exact match criteria. But the people that were the 7-county work group that I mentioned, our legal folks in the office, our elections and legislative matters, the vendor, ESNS, had other states they had done, implemented and had suggestions on how those states went about that, as well as getting with the Department of Corrections, Health and Environment. They had some input in those decisions, and we had JAD sessions and so forth to arrive at that. I do know that there was a lot of discussion, particularly on felon aliases and so forth. I don't remember all those particulars, but I do know that that was an issue they struggled a little with, and how to, you know, present those matches and so forth. But, yeah, again, I don't know the specifics of the match criteria.
You're talking about within the state?
Yes.
All right. It's been, you know, basically standard practice, and I can't think of WACR law that specifically addresses it, but it's always been last name, first name, date of birth. And we've been, and then in terms of the final arbiter, that's to determine a possible match. And then to make the determination of whether we're going to decide that these are records for two different people, we use the signature comparison. And that's always reviewed by a human person. And the counties also make the determination of which record should be the active record. And they base it on some of the same kind of things I thought I heard you talking about. Which county did they vote in last? Which county did they update their address in last? You know, those kind of things is what they make their decision on. Really die, you mean?
Are you doing it on last name, first name, date of birth for that, or do you have additional?
Wendy, we also subscribe and use the Master Death Index from the Social Security Administration, and we also make LexisNexis available. We hold, kind of manage a statewide contract for all the counties so they can access the public records through that, so they can kind of get creative in how they make, once we have a potential matchup, they can use LexisNexis as a source to confirm. And then I was going to, when it got to me, underscore the difficulty and challenges around the felon voting. We don't have access to federal list. In our state, and I'm sure other states, there's not a clear process. So that remains a challenge. And so we take it at the highest level, and then the counties have to investigate from there.
I just say on our death records, we don't do anything automatically. In fact, the felon records are the only ones really automatically. The death records are put in the system and paired with potential matches, and individual counties then their workers look at them and make the decisions rather than it being an automated process. They're provided with all the data that we get from vital statistics concerning it, and all potential matches.
Okay, if we are out of
any special or any kind of problems for overseas people are registered voters overseas, particularly in the military, any problems that occur because if on election day or as it comes about.
Many problems, and biggest one is timing, because we're always struggling to have everything ready for the election by the time those have to go out, and that's the biggest problem with it. But of course, there are also addressing issues, and we're struggling with some issues concerning identifying which elections individuals are trying to vote for, which happens to be where they're selecting certain elections that they want to vote absentee. Not that it doesn't do that, but we're going to change the way it's going to do that, I guess. So there are some issues with that. It's timing is the biggest one, though.
Okay, I think it's time to open it up for questions from the floor.
Two quick questions. The first one's for Paul. Your description of the internet registration process and the use of the DMV signature as the official signature raises an interesting question about obsolescence of reference signatures. Since people will regularly renew their driver's licenses more frequently than their registration, will your new system have the capability to absorb the later signatures from the driver's license process? And my second question is for the whole panel, and that is, what is your cost annually in terms of dollars and manpower, FTE headcount, to maintain your systems, including John on that question.
The short answer is yes, we would like to use the DMV signatures to update the voter registration signatures. We think that will probably require legislative changes in our state law. Two issues. One is because their signatures are more recent signatures than some of the signatures we have in the database, and better, and in some cases better quality, that would be really be helpful for the automated signature verification process. But right now, legally, we don't have the ability to do that.
I'll try to address your second question. It's hard right now to quantify the number of FTE hours we have just dedicated to voter registration database maintenance. We have we have three developers who are working on the online voter registration application, but they also conduct regular list maintenance activities. We have two staff, or one staff who's dedicated to providing customer service to counties and helping them resolve VRDB issues. He does that about half time. So I would say in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 FTE annually. It is kind of hard to split out the duties, but it's not a lot of people at this point. And in fact, one thing we're hearing in terms of, you know, how big of a presence the VRDB is in the life of the counties, when we visit the counties and we talk to the auditors, they don't really even mention or recognize the VRDB as an ongoing issue anymore for them. We ask them how it's going, and they're, I don't know, it's going fine, talk to my staff. So we think that it's pretty low maintenance in the counties as well, and that we've got a good system in place between the folks we have in the county to the people to do it.
And what about the budget in dollars?
Well, as Paul pointed out, it was $6 million to develop, and I don't know, I can't tell you right now how much we have in maintenance. Do you mean in addition to salary for the FTEs? Okay.
However you allocate to that line item.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Sorry. Mike?
In Kansas, again, the quantifying the FTEs, we don't have, other than maybe a project manager who has some responsibility for oversight and managing the vendor portion of it, a lot of those duties were absorbed. And since the vendor is responsible for the ongoing maintenance, a lot of those day-to-day kind of oversight are absorbed by our existing staff, so our network person, security person, database people, you know, oversee that, but the vendor has most of that responsibility. And our election staff, it did bring on quite a bit for them that they were not, I don't say used to, but that this wasn't part of their day-to-day functions, dealing with a lot of questions about the system from the counties and so forth. As far as dollars, it was $5.7 million initially for the implementation, and through the vendor, $400,000 per year, I believe. And for the connectivity, it's between $150,000 and $200,000 a year for connectivity.
As I mentioned, one of the worst things that we did is not identify those and just left it in the budget for the office. We probably spend about 2.25 FTEs on it full time. That includes all customer service requests from all of the counties, training, and changing of the application. I don't have a firm figure, 200,000-ish.
Our system in Oregon is probably of the three up here most similar to Kansas's. And like Kansas, as part of our original contract, we included 5 years of maintenance in terms of the original contract with the vendor. So the vendor does about $1 million of maintenance a year for us. In addition to that, we have the equivalent of 1.5 employees on our staff who are one who is devoted to issues full-time dealing with our voter registration system, and a manager that oversees that person in addition to some other things. So we figured that When we were developing our system, we were told that you should, for budgeting purposes, assume that your annual maintenance costs will be about 20% of your development and implementation costs, and it has worked out to be exactly that. We had it cost us $5 million to put the system together, and it's costing us about $1 million or a little over to maintain it on an annual basis.
I just wanted to say to Ray, being an IT person myself, that my hat's off to, I guess my hair's off to you for taking that on in-house in New York State. I grew up on a farm in a small rural country, so we sort of took the outhouse method. We sat and thought about it for a long time. And and I had one quick question for Kansas. Security-wise, do you have any problems with Elvis impersonators? But seriously, the real reason I came up here was to really to talk to the committee, not the panel, because I think you should consider the cross-state clearinghouse and however it gets done very, very carefully before making any recommendations. I may be able to handle transactions coming in from an Oregon or a Kansas or a Washington against my database, but they don't want to see my 12 million voters coming at them. And they probably don't want to see California's 12 or 14 million voters coming at them. 20 million? Yeah. So as far as that goes, if you multiply 50 states by 50 hitting each other times the number of voters in the country, that's a lot of transactions going over the wires nationally. I don't think it's necessarily undoable as a national clearinghouse. You wouldn't want to put together a national database, but you could put together a national database of a checksum string that could be hit against. If everybody was using the same checksum string and you come up with a match of checksum strings and say I match a checksum string against the vote of Washington or the state of Washington, then I go against the state of Washington and say this is the person I'm looking at. So there are ways of doing it, but I would think about it very, very carefully before I make any recommendations.
Thank you. Commissioner?
Hi, I've got a question that I'd like to know. Basically, if you find that you have taken off a voter, registered voter, and it might be an error, on election day, they're able to vote a provisional ballot. Do you then check that provisional ballot against, do you have enough information to know how you deleted that person so you can go back and really make sure that how and everything like that, so you can count their vote if it was an error?
The intent is always to know, and we certainly have a history of all changes to an individual record. We never delete one, so there are ways to do that, to come back and find it.
And your law does allow them to vote.
Yes.
Correct?
That's right.
I would echo that. We don't delete voters either off the roll. They're put to different statuses. So I think very similar to what Ray said.
Ditto. Ditto. I want to say ditto to the gentleman that preceded my chairman, Chairman Davidson, about the federalizing of these comparisons, and wonder a little bit about the why. And do you believe it's required by HAVA? Or is it just something that once you had a statewide database, you thought, well, let's look at the state next door?
Mike, you want to take that on since you got two different ones of them going on?
I thought that was to the committee. As to the why, I'm the technical implementer, so are the powers above. Have really said the why. Their approach has been a regional approach. To get some value out of that, like I said earlier, between Missouri and us is the biggest value we saw, and why not include some of the other border states? And you know, we have seen the majority of them are between Missouri and us, but with some of the other states, we have found some that are potential matches. So our office feels there's value in that. Whether it's the policy on the nationwide database, we just decided again to take this in a small chunk and get some value out of it ourselves.
Okay, but I think, does anybody else want to answer up here?
Yeah.
It's probably a political expectation, and there are definitely people who are, particularly in the border areas, who are registered in both states. And when and on the West Coast, where we've got a lot of absentee voting, it's very possible that they're getting ballots from both states. And so this is, you know, we have done some small pilots and don't think there's a problem, but it's something that we feel we need to be able to say we've investigated it, and this is what we found. We found that X number of people appear to have registrations in both places. Four people appear to have voted in both states. When we investigated it, we found that they were clerical errors in the counties and nobody voted in both states. But it's something that we feel we need to know.
Yeah, Commissioner Rodriguez, I think for those of us in the Northwest states, when we met on this, I think there was universal agreement among the states that it would be a good thing to do from the standpoint of boosting voter confidence in the quality of our voter registration lists, that we were not leaving ourselves open to people voting in more than one state. And also, there was a prevailing feeling at the time that because all of these databases are public and people can easily purchase a complete copy of any state's voter registration database, that if we didn't do it, somebody else would do it for us, and then suggest that there were a whole lot of people voting in more than one state at one time when it may not be true, and that it would be better for the elections officials to be in charge of this process than to have some ad hoc groups out there doing it for us. Paula.
Official person, but just as to why I'm volunteering my time to work on this, and that is that I believe that if we had the capability when someone moved from state to state to move their voter registration with them, that we would have a higher participation in our elections. I think that this is technically possible, and I think it'd be a good thing to do.
Chris, I think we have time for one last question.
I'd like to commend the panel for their systems. I think it's really enheartening to see where this is, where it's gone. I happen to be a top-down person, so for you guys on the end, I really commend you. And Paul, I know you're halfway there, so and you've got a great system. just a couple points. We do, through the driver's license, there are surrendered driver's license information that goes back to all the DMVs when somebody moves from one state to another, surrenders their driver's license. If you can tap into that, that is good information. We have found that's worked very well. In terms of digitized signatures, we are using the driver's license digitized signature, and we have populated our voter registration with that. And the beauty with that is we get a new one at least every 8 years. So we're not stuck with a signature that was made a decade or two decades ago. So those are some things that you might want to consider. Thank you.
For those of you who may not know everyone in the room, that was Chris Thomas, the director of Michigan, who's one of those rare states where the Secretary of State's office is in charge of both DMV and elections.
Like to add to that, a model that was just described currently in place for driver records could be looked at by the committee for voter. That's simply a pointer database, who's got the record, and if I want to go get the record and perhaps even bring over voter history, you could do that with that kind of model.
Thank you. I think we've come to the end of our time. It's time for a break. The schedule says that our break is from 3 to 3:15, and I'm sure that Governor Walker here will want you back in this room exactly at 3:15.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much to the panel. Thank you very much.